You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collection of cycles of Rudolf Steiner, Collected Works, Volume 181, main title Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. I'm on the second cycle, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, and this is the end of that cycle, which is seven lectures, numbered lecture 14 in the book, given in Berlin on the 21st of May, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. In the past, at this time of year, we have often considered matters that relate to the festival of Whitsun. But as I have frequently said, the turmoil of events facing humanity at present is so great, and diverges so greatly from the ordinary course of human history, that ordinary reflections on the festivals seem out of place. Too often and too easily these reflections may, albeit unwittingly, distract us from the catastrophic events surrounding humanity. Nevertheless, the meaning of the Whitsun festival can have a bearing on these events, and it may still be permissible to reflect upon it. From past talks on Whitsun, we know that its most essential aspect is the individualization of a common life of shared experience amongst those who participated in the great Easter event of humanity. The tongues of fire descended on the head of each single person, so that each one learned to grasp the very nature of the mystery of Golgotha flowing through human evolution, and in a language unlike any other, and therefore comprehensible to all. The tongues of flame descended upon the head of each individual. Previously, one can say, the souls of the separate disciples felt themselves enfolded in the general aura of the mystery of Golgotha. But at Whitsun, what they only knew together in their communal life passed over into each separate soul, so that each one received his own illumination. I am, of course, putting it in abstract terms, but this is the most important aspect of Whitsun. We have to find a sense, a feeling in our soul, of the individualization of the Easter message through the annunciation of Whitsun, if we are to understand this festival in the right way. Then, in terms of the Whitsun annunciation, we can also grasp what spiritual science seeks to achieve. You see, one of its most fundamental endeavors is to enable every human soul to find an inner spiritual core that illumines the universal goals it strives for. As humanity develops in future, individuals ought to become ever less reliant on the social structures that encompass them, each becoming, hopefully, mature enough to live in a way that allows the other an equal life alongside him. Then inner tolerance will inhabit human souls, and freedom can be realized in society. There is no other way than this to realize freedom in the world. In other words, the Whitsun message must enter each single human soul. The Whitsun message is exemplary for how each must work inwardly with others and together take up what the science of the Spirit offers. Thus, in a sense, we can say that spiritual science itself is a perennial, continual, enduring Whitsun annunciation. If we cultivate these insights on our own soil, the modern age can teach us the need for patience above all. There are friends among us today who, from the outset, have worked inwardly to develop our spiritual scientific movement. 15, 16, or even 17 years have now passed since these beginnings. Yet we must always remember how little, how very little indeed, so far has been achieved during this time. And from this follows the next thought, that we must arm ourselves with great patience as we reflect on how the science of the Spirit and what it can be and become through us can actually lead to a re-enlivening of human existence. What spiritual science can become? We must always compare this with our tiny achievements in the past decade and a half. It is true that many have assimilated what spiritual science offers humanity, and yet, as is clear from our numerous reflections, this is still only the very tip of the iceberg. Spiritual science still needs to flow into society and its structures, into the whole life of modern humanity. If we are to grasp this fully, we must also relate it to another thought that rings in our ears today, and at every moment from all current world events, embodying a certain conflict into which the human soul is driven and which has now reached a certain culmination. Readers aside, I don't believe I gave the date for this lecture. This is lecture 14, given in Berlin on the 21st of May, 1918. End of readers aside. Our spiritual scientific research is founded first and foremost upon a flow of supersensible spiritual reality into the human soul. The science of the Spirit allows us to perceive that spiritual life has always continually flowed into human beings as humanity evolved, and yet that everything occurring on earth can only be seen as progress insofar as people know how to awaken to outward existence what streams into them from the world of spirit. Such a thought ought really to pervade our whole life of feeling. We ought, for instance, to be able to connect it with our more academic knowledge of history, and from this perspective see how it applies to modern culture. We should be able to ask ourselves, for instance, as an hypothesis, of course, and yet such hypotheses lead to realities of thinking, what would have happened if, say, Columbus or someone like him, someone very much connected with the development of modern humanity, such as Gutenberg, the inventor of modern printing, or even Luther in the 8th or 9th century, had been born at a different historical epoch? What destiny would then have awaited the individuals who bear these names? Born at a different era, they would most certainly not have become what we know them to have been from our studies of history. Of course, this did not happen and is hypothetical, since world evolution has its own karma. And yet these thoughts lead to realities. Such individuals would then have become people unknown to mainstream history. And yet we cannot imagine that modern times would have arrived without, say, the invention of printing, or that the Reformation would not have occurred. This tells us, chiefly, that something is communicated to humanity from the world of the Spirit, so that we come to see, to a far greater degree than the contemporary world is able, that the human being is an instrument by means of which spiritual realities enter earthly life from the world of Spirit. In relation to such things, as I have said, we find ourselves amidst fierce conflict today. The contemporary world does not acknowledge that a spiritual stream of evolution flows or trickles down into earthly events. It does not acknowledge that the human being is merely an instrument, and the society it seeks to develop is one where this is not acknowledged either. It seeks to develop a social order that takes account really only of the individuals here, upon earth. The most extreme caricature of this position is found today, as mentioned recently, in Leninism or Trotskyism, in views of society acknowledging only the very earthly individual. I am not thinking so much of the theories involved here. That is the least of the problem, but their real consequences for life. Lenin or Trotsky are trying to organize and structure society even in an area where it is least appropriate, as if nothing else exists than the separate physical human being. This ideal has been developing for decades now in socialist theories, and Leninism and Trotskyism are only the last grotesque birth pangs of a view that has long been forming. So, given this, how can we find our way back to the meaning of the Whitsun event? Certainly, it is true that an individual life of mind and spirit must come to illumined rebirth in each separate disciple. But this must be a life of spirit, by virtue of which the greatest conceivable degree of reality, for which we are but an instrument, is imparted to the separate parts of a whole. At the same time, the Whitsun Annunciation has another meaning too, the most important of all. The assurance that a human being does not relinquish any of his worth by becoming an instrument for the spirit that flows continually into humanity. We retain our personal value despite this. This is not just a theoretical insight, but something with consequences for life, which needs also to inform the ways we conceive of the state, morality, and the life of society. A thought is important in its awakening, kindling power, and an archetype of this, of course, is found in the tongues of fire descending on the head of each one of the disciples. To sleep through current events, as is so commonly the case, is to sin against them. And yet in the cycle of evolution in which we now find ourselves, it is quite impossible to awaken to the real nature of events if we do not reflect upon them with a certain inner mobility, if we are unable to distinguish what is essential and true from what is inconsequential and false. Today, we are inundated with a flood of newspaper journalism in which a vast amount of dross conceals perhaps just a line or two of huge real significance, pointing to what is really happening as an archetypal phenomenon, to use a Goethean expression. The rest is just so much wasted ink. We need to awaken an inner sense in us of what is truly important and essential, and what is of no consequence in all this. And this faculty can arise in us if we are unconsciously acquire the great world perspectives spiritual science can offer. We have to try to integrate this sense and intimation, try to feel as we can when spiritual science comes to life in us. To do so, however, we need to develop inner trust in what we fathom with our feelings, in our intuitive capacity, to a far greater extent than people today are accustomed to. Anyone who expects an inkling he acquires today to shed light tomorrow on actual events will usually not make great advances with his powers of true observation. Something may be true, but events can conceal it, and it may, perhaps, only come to tangible expression in the distant future. Here it is necessary for us to place ourselves into the world in the right way and develop true ideas about what is happening there. Extremely important things are happening in the current stream of evolution, and these can be detected in actual events if we know how to observe them, as I have indicated, by distinguishing the essential from the non-essential, and having the courage to do so. To draw out one strand only, the British Empire is in the process of becoming insignificant, and its outward reach and power, its specifically British attributes, are transferring to a kind of general Anglo-Americanism. This is happening right now. British dominance will tend to fade into pan-Anglo-Americanism, and this is very much a part of the development we have been speaking of, and is not at all at odds with it. It is actually extremely important to focus very clearly on such a key thought, since it does matter a good deal whether we allow true or false powers to inform our thinking. As I keep reiterating, the times themselves can teach us a great deal in this respect. Many soldiers have been transformed by their war experiences, as everyone knows who is familiar with the facts. There is no scope here to discuss the nature of this transformation, but there are also a very great number who have been at the front, who still think as they did in July 1914, still resort to precisely the same concepts as they did before, and have therefore learned nothing. In speaking to such people, one finds that they still say exactly what they would have said in July 1914. And yet anyone who is in the least awake will give every concept a different weight and color after these events. And this is why we will have to ask, as a very serious and in fact Christian question of conscience, where we can find the people today who prior to July 1914 were fully aware of the possibility of events taking shape as they now have done. Or I could formulate the question a little differently, and you will realize this is not mere whimsy. In the lecture cycle I gave in Vienna before the war, you can find that I described human society as containing something comparable to a carcinoma, a cancer in the life of humanity. That was something that needed to be perceived at the time, though many still have not done so. And so I ask this: has any understanding of this idea of a carcinoma in human evolution developed yet? You see, spiritual science must be taken seriously if it is to be applied to current events. A great part of the reason why spiritual science is so widely rejected is that people feel very uncomfortable with its seriousness. While many enjoy it theoretically, they feel very, very uncomfortable at the seriousness of its implications for life itself. All this, I hope, will lead us to understand more clearly something that I must now include in our reflections, and that it is important to consider if one wishes to understand the very foundations of spiritual science. In trying to understand things in the world, people today always feel they need to draw their understanding from what is happening at present before their eyes. But the spirit cannot be sought only in this way. If, for example, one wishes to understand the workings of spirit in the human being, it is not enough to consider this human being in present terms only, between birth and death. Why is this? Let us say that you are 50 years old or some other age, and have an inner life that is connected with the powers of the sentient soul. An immediate perception of the present will make you think that you possess a sentient soul, which expresses itself when your inner life of feeling expresses itself. But that is simply not true. In fact, your sentient soul developed between the age of 21 and 28, and what lived in your soul then, and came to an end when you were 28, ceasing to live in the soul, still has an after effect that you draw upon today when you consider the powers of the sentient soul. You make use not of present powers of the sentient soul, but of the powers you possessed back then. The past is at work in you. And it is therefore not true to say that the present accounts for everything at work in you. The past also has an after effect. The world of spirit has to be grasped as music, a music that is real. You would never be able to remember a melody if you forgot the first note by the time the third note arrived. The first note is still working on in the third, is contained and active in it. In spiritual activity, things do not just work on by being retained in memory, in the mind, but they carry on working as a reality. The effects of past forces of spiritual life are continually present in diverse parts of the soul, like the different aspects of soul and spirit, though in a different sense. Our reality as 21 and 22-year-olds continues to work in us when we are older, goes on existing. It exists in so far as it existed in the past, not as a present reality. to form new ideas, and what I have now described is, for instance, a new idea not to be found in the range of accustomed ideas today, is uncomfortable for people. They do not wish to acknowledge that when they are old and gray-haired or bald, they still speak and think with the powers they possessed in their youth or childhood. And it is simply the truth to say that your experiences at school and what you do from age 18 to 28 live on in you, continue to work in you for the rest of your life. You cannot replace this by other powers, except by turning to the sources which spiritual science opens. This is the only means to make good something lacking in life. You will not be surprised to hear that many people do not make productive use of their lives, and this is connected with our education system. You see, we cannot develop something that has not been planted in us in childhood, has not been implanted through the ordinary powers by virtue of which we address our essential human nature. There is a great deal involved in properly understanding such ideas. As I keep trying to accentuate from many different angles, above all, it involves learning to have much greater or deeper faith in life, in the spirituality of life. It is relatively easy for people today to believe, say, in their spiritual origins, to conceive of a spirit, originating in a world of spirit, connecting with genetic inheritance through the generations. But this is not sufficient. Above and beyond this, we need to believe not only in the spiritual origins of some aspect of our life, but of the whole of it. Because the evolutionary tendencies in humanity that I have often described, we believe that our development has been more or less concluded by the age of 20. In our 20s, we believe we are mature enough to stand for election to a municipal council or parliament, that we have all the faculties we need by that age to make the right judgments. By then, people think, they have long overcome the age of immaturity, when each year brought new capacities. We expect the different stages of childhood will bring with them changes and developments in inner faculties, and this comes to radical expression at puberty in particular. But after the age of 20, we no longer think there is much further development. We think we have finished developing and do not expect to see any further incisive developments. And this is understandable if we stay with an ordinary view of things. However, we can look at it like this instead. In corporeal terms, we do not grow older than 27, at which point bodily development has concluded and has nothing more to offer. Anything which is to contribute to our further development must then be drawn from the spirit, and when this happens, it unites with our soul. Very few will acknowledge nowadays that by the age of 45 you can gain a different order of experience through inner insight than you can have as a young whippersnapper of 21. Few credit how fertile and productive aging can be. How much can be gained by growing older? And the very absence of such belief obstructs this inner development, does not allow it to unfold. Since people do not attend to the new revelations each year, would otherwise bring them. Consider how much would change in human life if this belief gained currency, so that people knew they should wait for an older age to experience things that cannot be experienced beforehand. This would cultivate expectancy and hope in life, something so lacking today. But beyond its personal significance, think what huge importance this would have for the whole of human society. Alongside all the leveling impulses, as I will call them, that are playing their part today, consider how human fraternity would benefit if people realized that a person of 40 can have changed and developed through experiences we cannot yet have at 20. If this were a natural sentiment, consider its effect on the way a person of 27 would relate to a 40-year-old. Today, of course, this cannot yet happen, since a 70-year-old is often actually no older than a 27-year-old. Those of highest standing in society are often no older than far younger people and do not even notice this. As yet, therefore, this hope has no reality. But life must bring these developments. The future is asking us to start to grasp spirit as reality again. Today, people generally acknowledge spirit only as a sum of abstract concepts. They arrive at a sum of abstract concepts, such as can very well be developed up to the age of 27. And yet, real, tangible spirituality is connected with the fact that in our life on earth, between birth and death, we first have a burgeoning, flourishing life in corporeal development, concluding by the age of 28. And that from the age of 35, this physical life begins to decline. This tangible spirituality changes and develops in a way that we can say is opposite to that of our external development. Outwardly, we grow old, get wrinkles, but our ether body, or body of formative forces, grows younger, continually younger. Today, people pay no attention to this body of formative forces that grows ever younger. People go bald, get gray hair, and have no idea that they have at the same time a body of formative forces burgeoning and flourishing all the more as they go gray and lose their hair. Nor that precisely then this can endow them with capacities they could not possibly have had earlier on. Lack of awareness of this is due to the nature of the age we live in. But this is an aspect of the age that needs to change. Our time needs new concepts. In particular, our thoughts need to become healthier and more vigorous and cease to cling to externals, which leads to severe short-sightedness in all areas. We need to learn to use thoughts to penetrate reality in whatever field we explore. For example, we cannot understand history if we cannot complement outward knowledge with inner wisdom. For various reasons connected with the fracture or break in humanity's evolution, we have ceased to understand various aspects of grandeur that were previously perceived atavistically. People today consider themselves original in various fields. Quite a while ago now, in a lecture at Dorna, I raised this question. What would an audience say about a production of Goethe's Faust, which, after Faust has collapsed before the earth spirit, shows the character of Wagner as Faust in somewhat modified form, but still nevertheless identifiable as Faust? Actually, a director ought to try staging it like this, and I will explain why. Think of the great figure of Faust, elevated to cloudy heights, and then think of the pedantic character Wagner, who is frequently portrayed on the stage as hobbling about rather awkwardly. Faust despairs of the various sciences, and this is usually regarded as something very profound, although in fact there are many today of little depth who trivially entertain this idea. Many today respond to the idea that we should grasp the world of spirit by pointing to the deepest ideas in Faust, for instance, of a self-sustaining and all-encompassing power, as this figures in Faust's conversation with Gretchen. People forget that Faust is speaking to a 16-year-old girl and is adapting what he says to her. The whole of humanity likes to take its lesson from these words, but in doing so it is reducing itself to the perspective of a 16-year-old girl. I have even known professors of philosophy who cite these Gretchen catechisms as the highest wisdom. But the telling point here, at the beginning of the play, is not that Faust is despairing of all the sciences, but that he is turning away from the sign of the macrocosm, from the whole world, in fact. Initially, he wishes to know nothing about how the human being is connected to the whole great encompassing universe. Instead, he turns to the earth spirit, and thus to what will reveal to him only what human beings possess by virtue of earthly powers. What the macrocosm reveals to him, he regards as a show or spectacle merely, and he turns away from it. And yet the earth spirit dismisses him. Faust thought he would be able to grasp, through the earth spirit, something that is connected with his deepest being, but the earth spirit brings him to the point of collapse and speaks these words to him, quote, "You resemble the spirit you grasp, not me," close quote. So now let us ask who it is that Faust grasps or comprehends. He himself says to the earth spirit, quote, "Not you? Who then?" close quote. And at this very moment, Wagner enters. And the message is this. Everything you have so far developed is mere feeling and yearning, and what you bear in you can be seen now before you in Wagner. Wagner is Faust's other nature, the true dramatic answer to his question. Faust is being asked to understand that basically in everything tangible he has so far developed, he has not yet become anything more than his own assistant. And this moment of self-knowledge aims to help him progress a little. This reality could be depicted on stage if one showed the two figures standing side by side in close resemblance. But to do this, it would require the courage to take these phrases, quote, "You resemble the spirit you grasp, not me," close quote. Quote, "Not you? Who then?" close quote. Far more seriously than has so far happened. One would have to accompany the dramatic action fully with these thoughts, which really can be found in the play itself. Taking this further, Faust has turned away from the sign of the macrocosm and does not wish to experience the powers that connect us with it, with the whole universe. This was fundamentally the position of Goethe himself when he wrote Part I of his Faust. And in making good what he omitted in his youth, at least he looks back on it during the Easter walk and through the Easter night, Faust advances beyond the stage of self-knowledge he encountered in the form of Wagner, and arrives at the point where he can recapture what he let slip by before, the message of Easter. Read what Goethe writes here. Wagner does not wish this. The words themselves are resonant with meaning. For instance, quote, "How is it that a shred of hope remains to him who always clings to shallowness? With greedy hand he delves for golden coins, yet glad is when he digs up worms." Close quote. It is inevitable that, quote, "no shred of hope remains," close quote, for such a person. This is what we discover through self-observation. Faust merely draws all the consequences, but at the same time recaptures what he omitted in his youth. He catches up with it again and recaptures it, and this leads him a stage further and higher. This is what justifies repeating the question, "Who then?" He now resembles the one who appears to him in the poodle, the figure of Mephistopheles. What is this really? It is the power that counters human striving and opposes us in the same way that Faust opposes the earth spirit when he wishes to have nothing to do with the macrocosm. These are the powers of Lucifer surfacing within us. For this reason, Mephistopheles is initially depicted with Luciferic features, and why in Part I of Faust Mephistopheles is largely a Luciferic being. But already by the end of the 1790s, Goethe was growing beyond the foundations of his youth. If you read the prologue in Heaven, you find that what he elaborates there is no longer bound up with the revelations of the earth spirit. Now he is preoccupied with the impulse that enters from the macrocosm. Goethe has grown beyond his own beginnings, and now something enters his soul that is enormously important, and if we can perceive it, allows us deep insight into his being. Goethe was familiar with the tradition of Faust legends in Teutonic mythology, and this included Mephistopheles. But at the moment when, hard pressed by Schiller, he continues writing Faust, Mephistopheles becomes a figure who, although Goethe himself is not fully aware of this, inwardly bothers him, and whom he does not properly fathom. Jakob Minor, a Faust exegeticist and someone who otherwise has some interesting things to say, found an odd explanation for why Goethe got stuck when he tried to continue the drama. He says it was because he was old, close to 50, when he took up Faust again. I can't imagine how, if one's poetic powers dried up by the age of 50, it would ever have been possible to write Faust, which depends upon the power of years beyond 50, and on drawing youthful vigor from a life led as Goethe knew how to do, as Goethe knew how to. But Mephistopheles did instinctively irritate him and prevented him getting any further. The Faust-Mephistopheles conflict would not come right. In his play, Goethe had engaged with the great questions facing humanity, but now Mephistopheles was preventing him getting further. The latter had assumed a luciferic character, involving powers that emerge from feeling life. But as soon as Goethe starts writing the prologue in heaven, Mephistopheles stands there in relation to the macrocosm, and it is no longer adequate just to leave Faust battling with powers at work inside human beings. It is no longer enough to give Mephistopheles a merely luciferic character. Goethe sensed this. I really have no desire to be pedantic, but I will quote a few lines simply to indicate something important. In the prologue, in heaven, the Lord says, quote, "Of all the spirits of repudiation, the rogue's the one who causes me least bother." Close quote. In other words, there are other spirits of repudiation. Yet in Faust there is only one, Mephistopheles. And now let us recall that in the prologue, Mephistopheles says, quote, "What I love best are full, fresh cheeks of bloom, for corpses I am not at home." Close quote. But at the end, as you remember, he does after all make strenuous efforts about the corpse. So what is going on? Goethe sensed that the single Mephistopheles figure he had received from the old Faust legend splits into two when you go out into the macrocosm. Goethe had a dual sense of the figure as both luciferic and Ahrimanic, and could get no further because there was no science of the spirit in his day. But later, when he needed to unite macrocosmic events and human concerns in the, quote, "classical Walpurgis Night," close quote, and at the end, where macrocosmic universality and humanity's experience are interwoven as one, Mephistopheles had to assume an Ahrimanic character. Goethe very largely succeeded in this. But really, everything that Goethe himself said about his relationship to his Faust drama conveys the sense of being stuck, of getting no further. In passing from the medieval legend with its folk character to a play of global reach, it is necessary to split Mephistopheles into two, a luciferic and an Ahrimanic being, and this is why Goethe found it so hard. Nevertheless, he succeeded. Naturally, I am not finding fault with Goethe in endowing his Mephistopheles with Ahrimanic traits as he approached part two of the play. A luciferic being loves, quote, "full, fresh cheeks abloom," close quote, whereas an Ahrimanic one is concerned with the corpse, since it imbues itself with all we experience in our capacities of sensory perception, and also our consciousness between birth and death. If we study an individual such as Goethe, we find how he retains youthful powers, yet continually draws on these to undergo new experiences in life. What emerges in such a remarkable way in Goethe at the end of the 18th century is not due to him aging, but to the crisis he went through, and this gave new birth to certain youthful powers, a kind of Whitsun miracle in him. What I have been saying here about Faust is elaborated further in a text about to be republished, entitled, quote, Faust, Goethe's Faust as Picture of His Esoteric Worldview, close quote, part one of a little book called titled The Distinctive Mind of Goethe. Part two of this booklet will include Goethe's thoughts on Faust, and part three, some commentaries on his title, Fairy Tale of the Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily. In speaking of these things, I wish to highlight the need to properly penetrate aspects of humanity's spiritual substance and culture, both now and in the past, and of giving proper weight to what we possess. Over the past 4 or 5 decades, you see, we have forgotten how to absorb the greatest aspects of humanity's past and give them full and serious attention. A great deal has been overlooked and neglected in the last 40 to 50 years, and now the cultural and spiritual riches that once existed need to re-emerge, though in a renewed form. Much of this was atavistic, you see, and for this reason was unable to break through certain barriers. The time was not yet ripe for Goethe to split the figure of Mephistopheles into two, a luciferic and Ahrimanic figure. Yet this duality lived in Goethe's nature. In a nutshell, we must learn to believe in the whole of human life and not just in childhood. We must learn to lead a life of expectancy. Just imagine what effect this would have if people looked forward expectantly to being 50. How many people nowadays look forward to this? How many people lead their life in a way that allows new content continually to flow into their soul? What changes would come about in society, too, if this faith in the whole of life were to take root in people? In fact, one simple thought can lead us to this faith in the whole of human life. It is this. Would there be any point in living to the age of 70, on average, if our development concluded at the age of 28? Would there be any reason for going on getting older? Here, though, to be taken seriously, we will need some help from science as a basis for spiritual scientific insights. I have said that the science of the spirit, and here I return to the beginning of today's lecture, has so far achieved remarkably little within our movement. Yet the prospect is not hopeless, as one can discern in many circumstances. We can best discern it, and this has often happened over recent decades, when young people studying at university approach us in an endeavor to find something that can connect their studies with spiritual science. These young people, at the outset of their lives, have a sense that every field of knowledge can be led over into the science of the spirit. This can give rise to the most fruitful seeds for the future. But the difficulties arise immediately when these young people, for instance, try to write a thesis that includes spiritual scientific insights that are certainly relevant to it. This cannot be done, for while spiritual science has a great deal to offer, people are prevented from pursuing it or compelled to turn aside from it. I can tell you of an instance, one long enough ago to allow me to quote it. It would be inappropriate to mention more recent cases, where a student submitted a thesis here in Berlin whose only fault was to mention my book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact. This was a philosophical and not a theological dissertation. The student asked me what he should do, explaining that his supervisor, Paulson, would not accept it as it was, that he could not quote Steiner. The only thing I could think of was to advise him to go to Münster and submit the thesis to Gideon Speicher. This did work. We have to see how things really are, enter into specific realities. The points of view one encounters in trying to embark on an academic career are sometimes very odd. A prospective lecturer, though one who got round this problem, as you will hear, once told me the following. He had written a paper on the work of a poet, I won't tell you which, as this has to stay confidential. Then he wrote a paper on Schopenhauer, and also, of course, a doctoral thesis. Now he wished to become an associate professor. He went to the university in question to see the professor about this, a person who liked him well and considered him very capable. He thought this professor would find it easy to appoint him to a lectureship. But the man told him this couldn't be done, since he had written a paper about a poet, about aesthetics. But this poet lived in the 19th century, and this was too recent, apparently. Then he had written a paper on Schopenhauer, which could not supposedly be regarded as strictly academic. Quote, "Well, what shall I do?" close quote, the man asked. And the professor told him to find some more or less unknown figure from an earlier period and write a paper on him. This will be easy, since there will scarcely be any previous literature on the subject. The prospective lecturer did this, found a literary figure in Italy from a long time back, about whom nothing had been written as yet, and wrote a paper about him which he himself thought most inadequate, an opinion shared by his supervisor. And yet this was a good enough basis for becoming an associate professor. I do not mention this to find fault with anyone. It is not a matter of individuals, since the supervisor himself found it ridiculous that he was obliged to impose these modern prejudices on his charge. And the other person, the one who wished to become an associate professor, found it all ridiculous, too. These were two extremely nice people, one older and one younger. It is nothing to do with the people themselves, but with the culture of the age, against which one can only make headway with strong, energetic thoughts. And strong, energetic thoughts are only possible nowadays if humanity is made fruitful by the Spirit, if we found what we build on, what a science of Spirit can give us. Whether we turn to Goethe or to the contemporary world, we will repeatedly hear this call, to renew our world of ideas, our world of feeling, to renew our thoughts in a way that runs strongly contrary to present developments. This, in turn, depends on the Whitsun miracle being fulfilled in each individual soul, so that in our catastrophic age, this miracle reveals itself as a renewal of life. Then human beings, illumined by the Spirit, can meet each other as individuals in a way that enables a common will, a common reflection, and a confluence of powers to develop and shape the spiritual structure of humanity. From each human individual must come what is needed for the future. We should not wait for a general message to which humanity hearkens, for this will not come. But it will be possible for an influx from the world of Spirit to light up in every single human soul. And then what should and must emerge will do so through the way human beings live and work together. That is the end of Lecture 14, and the seventh and last lecture of the smaller cycle, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, which is in this book, Collected Works, Volume 181, main title being Dying Earth and Living Cosmos.